an area of rather more persistent rain coming into the southern half of England and Wales. But as I say, Jim, quite a bit of uncertainty, so do stay tuned.
Not thrilling, is it?
Not really.
Thank you, Helen. Well, now we conclude our book of the week, An Englishman Aboard, Discovering France in a Rowing Boat, by Charles Timoney. Charles is now facing the last leg of his journey along the River Seine from his source in Burgundy, from its source in Burgundy, to where it flows out into the sea at Le Havre. The river is now too wide and dangerously busy with shipping to continue in the rowing boat, so he must find other ways of reaching Le Havre. After a meeting with the president of the French Amphibious Vehicle Club, Charles is in for a new experience. The reader is Mark Heap.
Walking down the quayside on the outskirts of a village not far from Bonnières-sur-Seine some time later, I got my first ever close look at an amphicar. It was bright red, with grey upholstered seats, the beige convertible roof neatly folded down at the back. Though it seemed vaguely improper to peer under someone's rear end when you've only just been introduced, I bent over and could clearly see two painted propellers lurking between the rear wheels. The change from land to water travel takes place fairly seamlessly. The car has two gear levers, one for road travel and a second lever for the twin propellers. At the bottom of the slipway, Christophe operated the two gear levers, and a wake started to form behind the car as the propellers took over propulsion from the wheels. It is against all reason. You are clearly in a car, for the steering wheel and the dashboard are right there in front of you, yet you are floating serenely down a major French river. It is quite simply wonderful. I swapped places with Christophe and took the helm, or rather, the steering wheel of the first river craft I have ever been on, with indicators and a rearview mirror, and a horn, and of course, a handbrake, even though pulling on it, or obviously pressing the brake pedal, would be a complete waste of time. A word of advice may be useful at this point. It is not half as funny as you might imagine to ask an amphicar owner what would happen if you were to open the car door. It does not go down well at all, though I imagine that's exactly what the car would do if you were silly enough to try. I can't remember the last time I took part in an activity that caused heads to turn the way they do when you tootle along a river in a small red car. Soon afterwards, I heard from a friend that his cousin, Jean-Francois, was coming to Paris to buy a second-hand sailing boat without a mast at a knockdown price. He was then going to take it home, spending a week chugging down the Seine. If we wanted to do part of the journey with him, we'd be welcome. We agreed that it would probably be a good idea for us all to meet over a beer or two to make sure that we could survive being cooped up in a boat together. Few things are as taxing as being confined in a small, rolling, pitching space with someone you don't get on all that well with. At the marina the next day, it was easy to spot Jean-Francois' boat, as, obviously, it was the one without a mast. It looked clean and well cared for. We walked to the stern and saw that someone had very artistically hand-painted the name Hirondelle on the back. It somehow seemed important to get the encounter off on a proper nautical note, so I called out, "Ohé du bateau!" "Ahoy there!" At this, the companion hatchway opened and a chap with a large reddish moustache, blue eyes and an affable expression emerged from the companionway. I liked him instantly. A couple of days later, we were dropped off in Elbeuf by our son, Sebastian. We'd come thoroughly prepared for the trip. We'd brought my folding bike, which, together with Jean-Francois' bike, would allow us to go off on forays into the countryside. We had also brought my boat. I thought a change of scenery would do it good. Rather than spend all the next day travelling along the river, Jean-Francois had suggested that we stop off in Rouen, some 20 kilometres downstream. This suited us perfectly. Rouen is the capital of Normandy. We slipped our moorings and headed off downstream. When Hirondelle emerged from the channel between the island and the quayside, Jean-Francois asked, "On doit être dans le centre, non?" We must be in the city centre, in a tone that sounded less certain than I would have liked. When we said that we were fairly sure we were in the city centre because wasn't that the cathedral over there to our right, Jean-François brightened visibly. He then started looking keenly along the quayside where a number of barges were moored until he spotted an empty space just long enough for the boat. On va le laisser là? We'll leave her there, he declared in the tone of one who had been expecting nothing less. We set about mooring Hirondelle, despite the fact that neither Inès nor I felt half as sure as Jean-François appeared to be about our right to just leave a boat wherever we felt like it. Rouen is known by its admirers as La Ville des Cent Clochers, the town of 100 church towers. This is not its only nickname. In this famously wet region of Normandy, Rouen stands out because it apparently enjoys an even higher rainfall than most of its surroundings. In view of this, the town is more commonly known, both by its critics and those who love it, as Le Pot de Chambre de la Normandie, Normandy's Chamber Pot. On the day that we spent exploring the town, we saw a remarkable number of church towers. It also started raining just as we tied up, and carried on raining for most of the time we were there. Back on the quay, I was relieved to see that Hirondelle was still there and, more importantly, didn't seem to have acquired any kind of parking ticket. My suspicion that we hadn't really been supposed to leave the boat by the quay all day was heightened by Jean-François's reluctance to spend any more time tied up there. For years, we used to race along the auto route to catch the car ferry from Le Havre to Portsmouth. I never realised how much we were missing. The journey to and from the car ferry had always been something to get over with as quickly as possible. It had never occurred to us that there might be something near Le Havre worth dawdling over. Well, there is. It is called the Marais Vernier. This is an expanse of reclaimed marshland that lies on the left bank of the river just after you've left the Parc des Boucles de la Seine. Whichever way you walk in the Marais Vernier, the land is so flat you can see what's coming up for miles. This is not a place for hurrying, and as you wander peacefully along, you pass apple orchards and fields with contented cows. These contented cows are busily contributing to Normandy's justifiable fame for its dairy products. Any recipe which includes the words à la Normande is going to involve generous quantities of cream or butter, very possibly both. At a village called Saint-Opportune-la-Mar, we came across an apple market. The stallholders were local growers, and all prided themselves on the varieties of apples they had on offer. These were mainly old varieties with wonderful names: Pigeonnet de Rouen, Gueule de Mouton, Choupette, Rouen Pigeon, Sheep's Face, Sweetie, and one which pleased me particularly, Royal d'Angleterre, English Royal. There are many apple enthusiasts in France who are keen to save old varieties. Indeed, we have one friend who recently declared himself to be a key member of an Association de Croqueurs de Pommes, an apple munchers club. The club has a conservation orchard which has some 100 different sorts of apple tree. There are two World Heritage sites that lie along the course of the Seine. One of them is the riverfront in Paris. The second, astonishingly, is Le Havre. For me, Le Havre is a town best known for being home to a ferry terminal and a dockyard, as well as for being surrounded by ugly petrochemical plants. In the course of the Second World War, the town endured 132 Allied air raids. The entire city centre was completely demolished. Unlike other French towns, which were unflatteringly rebuilt after the war, Le Havre set out to rebuild its city centre in the most thoughtful way possible. That the centre of Le Havre ended up on the heritage list is essentially thanks to the efforts of one man, the architect Auguste Perret. Perret set about creating a completely new city centre using his favourite building material, concrete. All Perret's buildings managed to exude a feeling of solidity and quality that you don't generally find with modern structures. there was one place that was particularly worth a visit. We had been aware of St. Joseph's for the whole time we'd spent in the city centre. The church has a tall central tower 106 metres high that we could see from everywhere we had been. We happened to walk in at exactly the moment that a christening was ending. We thus found ourselves face to face with two beaming parents who were proudly clutching their newly christened offspring. More importantly, we also found ourselves being offered dragées, even though we had nothing whatever to do with the christening party. As a general rule, I can happily go for months without tasting any kind of French sweet. The only exception to this is dragées. If there are dragées to be eaten, I'm your man. The dragée is an oval sweet with a hard outer shell, which is filled either with an almond or, less often, with chocolate. They traditionally come in three colours: pastel blue, pastel pink, and white, and are given as a formal gift to mark a special occasion. Dragées are quite simply delicious. Their only drawback is that it doesn't seem the done thing just to go to a shop and buy some whenever you feel like eating one. You have to wait to be given them. We cycled out to the seafront, and there was Hirondelle, just a few hundred metres away, pitching a bit but heading steadily for the harbour entrance. A short while later, our son Sebastian drove up, and we set about putting Jean-François's bike back on the deck and packing all our stuff back into the car. My boat, however, was left where it was, because it was about to take centre stage for the final part of the quest. For the last time on this trip, Inès and I cast off the mooring ropes. Once past the harbour wall, we were at sea for the first time, and my boat got its first ever taste of salt water. Away from the harbour, Hirondelle started pitching regularly as she met the swell coming in from the channel, my boat bouncing and swinging in her wake. Jean-François held his course for about 10 minutes, scanning the shoreline to our right, then observed, as ever, in his characteristic mix of uncertainty and optimism, "On dirait que l'on est là, non? It looks like we're here, aren't we?" He cut the engine, and we drifted to a stop some 50 metres off a cobble beach, where a small group of people in warm clothing were standing, watching us intently. "Oui, c'est bien eux." "Yes, that's them, all right," I agreed. Heading to the stern, I unfastened the boat's painter and pulled it alongside. It wasn't far to row, but I took my time, wanting to enjoy for as long as possible this final short stretch of water that would bring my quest to an end. All too quickly, the boat was cresting the surf, and with a final scrunch, we were ashore on the cobbled beach. It's late October, and I'm standing on this beach at Sainte-Adresse, the most northerly and most attractive suburb of Le Havre, with a great triangular estuary of the Seine stretching away to my left. It is a great moment. I pop the cork on the champagne, and there is much chinking and toasting among our friends. I have travelled the entire length of the Seine, from source to the sea, in the best part of a year. Of course, had I not stopped to explore along the way or spent all that time messing about in boats, I could probably have done it in a fraction of the time. But where would have been the fun in that?
The final episode of An Englishman Aboard, Discovering France in a Rowing Boat by Charles Timoney, was read by Mark Heap, abridged by Libby Spurrier, and produced by Joanna Green. And it was a peer production for BBC Radio 4. BBC Radio 4. Now the shipping forecast, this is by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015, today Saturday the 15th of June. There are warnings of gales in Thames, Dover, Wight, Portland and Irish Sea. The general synopsis at 1800, low just west of Rockall 994, expected Malin 997 by 1800 Saturday. New low expected just west of northwest Fitzroy 999 by the same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking north at Cira. Southerly backing easterly 5 or 6, showers good. South at Cira, northeast 40s. Southeasterly 4 or 5, becoming cyclonic 5 to 7 later, showers, rain later, moderate or good. Southwest 40s, Cromartie, Forth, Tyne, Dogger. Southeasterly 5 to 7, veering southwesterly 4 or 5.